This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Different Strokes. Stories and conversation about stroke, hosted by Natalie Cowie and Grant Gillette and supported by the Stroke Foundation.
Hi, I'm Natalie. I was a career high school English teacher and head of English for many years. I had a stroke 4.5 years ago, and I'm living with ongoing disability, which limits what I can do and has turned my world upside down. I have to be really determined now. I'm learning how to deal with my stroke, trying to find myself a new perspective on life and find myself again.
Hi, I'm Grant. Before my stroke, I worked as a neurosurgeon and a medical ethicist. Now I can say something about what stroke and stroke recovery is like from both the inside, my lived experience, and the outside, my medical knowledge and experience.
Today we have Jenny Temple, who's a retired school teacher, and she will be telling us about her stroke and her recovery.
I am Jenny Temple, a retired school teacher. I experienced a brain bleed in the right parietal lobe 6 years ago. I was fortunate to receive prompt medical attention and life-saving surgery from Mr. Taha.
Well, I always say to a patient, you need a hole in the head like you need a hole in the head, but you need a hole in the head.
Bit of neurosurgeon humour there.
Yeah. However, post-surgery ICU, my hold on life was tenuous. My family was assembled and told that a CT scan of my brain revealed a grim prognosis. The medical staff advised that I was most unlikely to survive and that the best course of action was to remove the IV lines and cease medication. I would likely pass away after a few days. It was therefore a great surprise to my family that the following morning I was alert and talking to a nurse.
That's amazing.
That's amazing. That is a real example of what Dirty Harry says. But this time for the doctors, a man's got to know his limitations.
I spent the next 6 weeks recovering from the stroke. Instead of doctors and nurses, physiotherapists became my new heroes. Initially, I had to learn how to eat, and learning to walk was a major focus. A very important milestone was being able to walk independently to the toilet without being frog-marched.
Yeah, I guess what we call allied health professionals, although that sounds a bit snooty, are often the people that really make a difference when people have to get back into their rhythms of life.
Absolutely, yes. Grant.
Yes. At the outset, I found it hard to believe that I'd had experienced a stroke. Why me? I was fit, had a low BMI, low blood lipids, low blood pressure, and was a non-smoker. Even my GP was surprised. However, despite the unknown cause, I realised that my good health probably aided my speedy recovery. Mm. I was discharged from hospital at the end of week 6 and celebrated soon after by walking the Ross Creek Reservoir track.
That is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you may realise that causality goes beyond all those things we try and control, but all that work you did on your fitness and everything else will have really made a difference to your recovery.
Yes, and I think I was always very into sport and into fitness all my life, so that was my big focus.
I think that's a really interesting point tonight about what caused your stroke, because many people think they are exempt for the reasons you have given, and I think it's good to know, not to be doom gloomy, but to let people know it can happen to anyone.
Yes, that's certainly with me that was the case. I've always been interested in medical research and have participated in several stroke-related projects. One of these research projects at Otago University involved upper body physiotherapy. This involved 8 months of daily physical exercises of an hour concentrating on my left upper limb.
Mm-hmm.
The project was timely as it coincided with my discharge from hospital. Even after all these exercises, though, I still have partial use of my left hand and arm. I had hoped to regain full recovery, but have slowly learned to live with it. I currently attend a gym 3 times a week, doing exercises concentrating on my left limbs.
That's fantastic. I mean, it really does let us know that a significant role is really played by that long recovery trajectory.
Mm. Mm.
That years ago, we didn't ever seem to take enough notice of. So we would say to people that you'll be done most of your recovering in 18 months. Well, how wrong we used to be.
Totally.
Yeah. After a year, I regained my driver's license with a modified indicator stem and steering wheel. Simultaneously, I returned to teaching part-time at the school where I had taught for 25 years.
That's amazing. How did you find returning to the classroom, Jenny?
Well, it was only part-time, and it was very tiring. Often I'd have just work an hour or two and then go home and have to have a sleep or a rest because of the tiredness.
Still, yeah. That's great. I mean, interacting with young people who are actively developing the skills they're going to take forward into life means that you yourself have an opportunity to share and think about which skills will help you go forward into life.
And it was great being able to return to my old life, even though it was part-time.
Yes, I'm envious.
Yeah.
In terms of neurofatigue, how do you find you are now?
I've got to be very, it's still there, but I have better at managing it. I have to watch out. I don't do too many things in one day.
Yes, that's understandable.
I can still live a full life, what I regard as a full life.
It is fantastic.
Yeah. Through the Stroke Foundation, I've found it helpful to interact with other stroke survivors, either catching up for coffee or going for walks. I also helped to establish an exercise class for stroke survivors in conjunction with the Otago University School of Physiotherapy. My competitive nature was evident when I competed in the walking race, often winning them.
Mm-hmm.
3 years after the stroke, I developed epilepsy, which I thought was another stroke, but was relieved to learn from a clinician that it related to tissue scarring from a neurosurgery.
Wow.
Unfortunately, I had to give up driving for a year.
Mm.
But that's, and it's all okay now.
Yeah, that's just another one of those challenges that we hope will not, you know, come along, but sometimes they do, and it's important not to be downcast by those.
No, well, in my case, I thought it was another brain bleed, so I was actually relieved to get that diagnosis.
Yeah, that.
And I'm on a very low dose of medication to control it, so I'm lucky.
Yeah, that sounds great. Have you had been able to regain your license?
Yes, just 1 year, and on the day I lost it, following year I regained it.
Uh-huh.
So now my struggle is just finding parks. Neurofatigue is a constant reminder of my stroke. However, over time I've learned to manage it with daily short rests, as I said before.
Neurofatigue is a burden, but I got to say, it's also a very nice reason to just switch off for an hour or so in the afternoon.
Yes, yeah. So overall, though, I'm grateful to be a stroke survivor. Each year gained following the stroke is a blessing.
Absolutely.
That's how I feel.
Yeah, kia kaha.
And I think, really, the satisfaction of re-inhabiting some of those life spaces, like for you teaching, for other people other things, reading and so forth, is just such a positive thing, quite a separate from what we might normally regard as rewards, because it just gives us that sense of self that you stand in such a risk of losing when you have
absolutely
a stroke.
That was very well put, Grant.
Yes, because I talk about reading. I'm a great reader, and I even became more of a reader since the stroke, because I can't do as many other things with my arm. As reading has just become, my library is my second home. So
wonderful.
And that is a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Reading really helps your cognitive recovery.
And and my own daughter said to me that my vocab has even improved from what it was before.
Absolutely.
Because a friend brought a book in on when I regained consciousness and gave it to me in the hospital, and I just started reading it and never stopped since, you know, then. I've always got two or three books on the go.
It's terribly encouraging, Jenny. One thing that really interests me is how much physical activity has been instrumental in your recovery, because I know that you do lots of walking. Can you tell me how you feel it has helped you in your recovery?
Well, it's helped my balance, lots of things, my muscle tone, and socialisation. I see many people when I do my daily walk up Signal Hill Road, we often stop for a chat, so that's getting the socialisation and encouragement from other people, and I'm getting physically fitter, keeping my low blood pressure and all those sort of things in order.
That's marvellous.
And I enjoy being outside and looking at gardens and things happening. I've got lots of friends in the neighbourhood, so I often chat with them.
You can go out for a bit of forest bathing.
Yeah, not there yet on that one, but that's not far away.
Oh, good.
And for me, and the guys or women like me who tend to be a bit lazy, your recovery of vocab and thinking by reading was a real encouragement, because I always find it easier to sit down and be lazy and have a read rather than do anything physical.
Well, read's really good for your brain. It's great. I mean, I read all the reviews and order the books from the library. We've got several friends we visit each other and we exchange books. So it's great. We're discussing plots and the characters in a book. Yeah, and you're always improving your vocab.
Absolutely. Yeah, big thumbs up for the reading there, Jenny. I'm very keen on it. I wish I could read again, but no such luck yet.
Well, thank you so much, Jenny, for coming in and catching us up on those various things that were so important for your recovery. Quite different things. And I guess it just reinforces the theme. Different strokes for different pokes.
Yes, Grant, you're absolutely right.
Yes, thank you.
Our guest is Professor John Reynolds from the Neuroscience Centre in Otago University, and he is very interested in brain plasticity, which, if you've never heard about it, means actually the ability to kind of bounce back and recover in unexpected ways after you've had a stroke.
Yes, thank you. Thank you all for inviting me to come along, and it's lovely to meet you all and to hear the various stories that we've heard in the last couple of days. So we're going to hear Natalie's soon, but we've heard yours, Grant, and we just heard Jenny's. And I think it's very important, first of all, before I tell you much about plasticity, to sort of acknowledge how important it is for us as researchers to be able to hear stories of people who live with stroke and their families, and really understand that it's, as the whole title of this is, very different to hear sort of challenges and the absolute triumphs that we heard from Jenny just saying just before, some of the things that she's achieved. So, and also, before I forget, to acknowledge the wonderful Stroke Foundation, who have helped us actually with our research. But Yeah, so I guess an interest in plasticity has come from when I first started my career in I did medicine, and I practiced in Whangarei for a few years and got to working in a rehabilitation unit. So I was a little older than most of the medics, and many of the young people don't really gravitate towards the rehabilitation unit because they want to be surgeons or whatever. I was very interested in it, and what was really interesting and frustrating for me is how little clinicians can do. I think you alluded to this in one of your talks. There's not a lot we can really do to be able to really help medically people with stroke. There's a lot of research going on to try and do that, but there isn't a lot because, as you say, it's the whānau, all the allied health professionals, you called them, and support that really help, and the people's willingness to really get on and recover.
But, John, I don't think you should undersell yourself here. I think doctors, when they wake up to rehab and their crucial role in it, can have an absolutely indispensable role in encouragement and support.
Sure, yeah, no, I'd definitely support that. Certainly the unit I worked in, we had some fantastic clinicians and nursing staff that really help. But I think when you get down to the, you know, is there something you could give someone to really help them recover from stroke? So that's what frustrated me, really, is that, of course, there are the therapies that we've heard a little bit about, the preventative therapies, keeping your blood pressure fine and thinning your blood if required, keeping your weight down, etc. And then those immediate rescue therapies that Wendy Busby talked about, like clot busting and retrieval, etc. Really, after that, you know, apart from really managing symptoms, there isn't a lot that we can really do to change the outcome. So, and that really got me interested when I came down here to Otago to do a PhD in neuroscience to actually understand how the brain really learns. And so we talk about plasticity, but it is effectively what we do all the time when we're listening and to somebody else and engaging and trying to understand and remember what they've said. These are all these circuits in our brain with one cell talking to another cell and changing the strength of those connections or those synapses. And that's really what's happening when we're learning. And that's what we try to harness after somebody has had a stroke, to try and get those connections going again. So that's why our therapists are so vitally important, and getting involved in therapy as much and often as you can is available to you, and of course that you can cope with in terms of fatigue, is to really regrow those connections.
That's so interesting, because I know you're really interested in upper arm, and since I've got a dud one, I'm fascinated by what you can tell us about that.
Yeah, so of course it depends where your stroke is as to when you have a motor deficit, whether it affects more your arm or your leg. Very commonly, obviously, as you know, affects the arm, and I think they say about 70-odd% to 80% of people who live with stroke have some degree of deficit in the upper limb. So I think that's what, because of my collaborations with fantastic therapists like Lee Hale and others, we decided we would really focus what we want to do on the upper limb, to perhaps give someone the chance that may not be able to lift a glass up very well to be able to do that. And I'm sure you would tell me how vitally important that is to be able to grab and lift things up.
It surely is, and I want to tell people who keep telling me that you can live with only one arm, you can live, but you can't live well.
Absolutely, that's the story we hear an awful lot. So that's one of the we focus, of course, not ever forgetting that one needs one's mobility, but in terms of being able to interact. And I think when we started our research program, we thought, okay, we're going to have to focus in one area on one thing that we can measure and change. And when we design a study where we're going to look at trying to enhance plasticity, really, we have to keep it very constrained, which is a little frustrating. I know talking with Kathy in our Stroke Foundation, who really helped us get the people that did get involved in the study, is we have to have these criteria. So we might say, well, can you take somebody who's not got very good lower limb function? Well, no, doesn't mean it's not important. It means that we've got to constrain what we can actually do and measure and study. So we did that, and I think at the time we were interested in this. there were people doing various what we call neuromodulation therapies that you will have heard about. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are therapies.
Now, that means using electricity and stuff to try and change the way the brain's firing, doesn't it?
Absolutely, thank you. I should say what I'm saying.
You've got to watch these specialists, you know. They have such highfalutin language that they leave
us. I was about to say, which means.
More brain behind.
Yes.
But some people got little things put in their head, didn't they?
So, yeah, there are various types of electrical stimulation, as you say. It's been actually put on the limbs. You can do it on the limbs and actually stimulate the muscles. There's magnetic stimulation that people have trialed putting on the head to try and wake those circuits up. Or electrodes on the top of the head. The particular approach that we took, which was actually very serendipitous at the time, because we were trying to investigate how magnetic therapy works, because people were using it to try and activate the circuits and see if people would recover from stroke. And it worked a little bit, but not as well as one would hope. So we wanted to actually have a look inside in animals and say, what does it do? And actually, quite by accident, my PhD student texted me one night and said, I've gone and applied the wrong protocol to this particular circuit that we're studying, and you know what? I've done something quite remarkable, and I don't know whether it's a one-off. And the thing that she did was, I'd have to first of all explain what the issue we think is, or one of the issues, is that when you have a stroke on one side of your brain, you obviously lose the ability to move those muscles. You can do on the other side mostly, unless it's at the back like Wendy was talking about, but these ones are crossover. But also you kind of end up with over-inhibiting the areas around the stroke. So the areas around the stroke are the ones that you want to wake up and retrain. And if they're being shut down, it makes it very hard to do that. So they're being silenced. And what she did, coincidentally, was accidentally found that when she stimulated the opposite part of the brain with a stimulation that people didn't usually use in these paradigms, she actually removed that inhibition. And by removing the inhibition, the next thought for us was, well, if we did it in an animal with stroke, would we enable that part of the brain to move better and indeed learn how to rewalk better? And so we did a number of experiments, and yes, it seemed to look like it was going to work better. And at that stage, we had a new neurosurgeon who came to Otago, Dirk de Ritter, who I happened to have breakfast with one time and was telling him about this experiment. And really, there seemed to be no barriers, apart from obviously all the correct going around, all the ethics, etc. There was no barriers for us to try that kind of stimulation in some people.
Now, that is a real good example of serendipity. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Serendipity Singers, and it's great to remember how these little moments in life, which you can't plan for, if you're creative enough, set off a train of thought which leads you to something really productive.
Well, I think, absolutely, I think the really amazing thing about him was that he... and he still does, is he has relationships with the companies that make these stimulators. And the reason that's important, because Parkinson's disease, it's very common to have a stimulator implanted in your brain. And they apply this sort of high frequency multiple pulses. But what I needed was something quite special, was kind of a special kind of burst stimulation that my student had applied for another reason, really. And I said to him, can we have a stimulator that does this? And he said, well, I could probably ask the companies to do this in America to program it for us.
Wow. Oh, they're sort of like pacemakers.
So we managed to get these stimulators programmed the way we wanted it to, and we set up a study with the Stroke Foundation, and we managed to recruit a couple of people prepared to have these stimulators put in. And cut a long story short, they all made pretty significant improvement.
Wow.
But it was a therapy that was designed to go on top of normal rehabilitation. I think that's a really important point, is that what we try to do in these cases is to augment normal efforts that come from rehabilitation therapy.
Excellent.
That is fantastic, because it just shows that in the many ways that in science we allow ourselves to be confined to focus on just one thing, sometimes we might be defeating our own efforts, which require a whole lot of things to work together to make something good come out of it.
Absolutely. The part of the problem was we only had a very small number of stimulators and we couldn't get very many people that were keen to go for the surgery. So we've since translated that to an external stimulator and we've done run through three people through it with an external stimulator sitting over the head. And two out of three of them also showed some good improvement.
How often do they have to wear it?
So the therapy, this is part of the challenge, is that we needed people to have quite a lot of therapy to come every day, you know, 3 to 4 times a week and have the stimulator session. So it's an awful lot of demand.
It is a commitment.
On somebody with stroke.
But it sounds like it's more than worth it if you get this. Yeah. Your arm moving better.
Aye. And I think COVID has made it very difficult for us to carry that study on. But hopefully it'll be continued.
But really, I mean, we think of it in terms of burden. But as a stroke survivor, when you see yourself making progress, it's really not a burden. It's something you want to do because you want to make even more.
As I understand it, of course, it's part of the journey, though. We found this with the people who recruited for the operation. Some of them got literally to the day of the operation and said, no, I don't want to go through it because of that journey. It depends on where you are in your journey of recovery.
Yes.
And that's something I can't talk about, but you both certainly can.
One more question.
Yes,
Exoskeletons, what's the story there?
Okay, I can't tell you much about the research or current that's going on with exoskeletons other than what I've seen in the press, really. So, no, it's not an area that
I was watching it on YouTube.
Yeah, they're lifting people up and moving their arms.
Yes, they are. It looks amazing.
Yeah, it is pretty incredible what can be done. We've done a little bit of – I do some teaching and with brain-computer interfaces. So, you know, about these where you have them implanted. It's quite a lot of ethical issues, right? You have them implanted and they can move an external arm, and particularly more for things like spinal cord injury. But, of course, they're extremely hard to get to work.
So I imagine they are.
Lots of research.
When I saw them on YouTube, I thought, oh, my goodness.
Yes.
I bet that's hard to get working.
Yeah.
Oh, brave new world that has such people in it.
Very true. Bit of Chad Ball Shakespeare. And the professor here, you know a lot, Grant.
He does. His philosophy's amazing. This man taught me, actually.
Oh, how interesting.
We go back a while.
It was so interesting.
It really was. I mean, that'll just slot in that place where people can see that underneath all this, there is a kind of integrated science effort where various ways of coming at it are being combined. And I think in the popular imagination, often people write up something like it's in the front page of the newspaper. Right. This is the brand new thing.
Right.
And those of us who are at the coalface realise that everything's got its own little bit to fit into a much bigger picture.
That is so true.
So it's an absolute joining between community and research and medicine. I think it really needs to be quiet.
It's just fabulous to know what's going on.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you, John. I hope you've enjoyed Different Strokes. There is a wealth of information out there. The best place to start is the Stroke Foundation.
So if you want more information about stroke, just to remind you of the Stroke Foundation, and also their website, strobe.org.nz, or phone 471 6175. And you can listen to a podcast of the show on oar.org.nz.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.